Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit community credit union now open in downtown Bellevue, serving members at their newest branch at the corner of Northeast 2nd and 108th Avenue Northeast. More information at WSECU.org.
I was working at Real Change newspaper as assistant editor, and I had a coworker who said, "Hey, have you heard about this vendor here? His name is Bryant Carlin. He goes out to the Olympic National Park with his camera and stays for a couple weeks at a time and takes these pictures. They're really pretty good."
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. It's Sound Effect. And this is Seattle journalist Rosette Royale.
So I thought, oh, great. I'll just interview him. Then that's easy to do. And then we have photos from his trips and bam, bam. Like, that's a quick story. It's done. Sold. So I set up a time to meet Bryant.
First, I'd just like to ask people their name.
Bryant Carlin.
Bryant slept on top of a picnic table in Woodland Park. When it was warmer, he slept in the horseshoe pits. You know, there's an area where there are horseshoe pits there.
You described yourself as a visual immersion photographer?
You know, he's got this urban existence, homelessness, alcoholism. He is a drinker of malt liquors. One of those cans is about 3 cans of beer. So Bryant can drink 2, 3, 4, 5 of them a day. Every day. And then he's got this outdoor existence where he's this fantastic outdoorsman, wild man, weeks alone with a camera.
I usually take no less than 2 weeks in a single location.
His photos tell these amazing, beautiful stories of this world that is so close to us. And so I was really, really impressed with his ability to take pictures.
And I pretty much just relax into the wilderness and let it unfold in front of me.
I asked him, of course, how did you wind up doing this? What led you to go to the Olympics? And he kind of got quiet for a few seconds. And then he told me how he was living in Alabama.
23rd, 22nd, doesn't matter. It was one of my birthdays. I went down to Florida. I got in trouble for DUI. And I was sitting in jail in Florida, in the library in the jail in Florida had an Alaska magazine. And I was like, man, I got to do something else with my life. And I just decided I was going to go to Alaska and be a photographer.
And then 6 months later, he moved from Alabama to the Northwest. And he had a coworker, and the coworker said, why are you going to go to Alaska? You can just go to Olympic National Park. It's just a couple hours away. And Bryant went to the park and fell in love. And so ran the interview in the paper, and then I just kind of got caught up in work. And I would run into Bryant every, 2 or 3 months. And he would say, hey, you want to go out to the Olympics with me? You know, I'm going out in a couple weeks. The elk will be bugling. Or, you know, the wildflowers are just going to be blooming. Every time he asked me, I had a great excuse. Oh, I'm too busy with work. Oh, I'm going out of town that weekend. And so they were all kind of little lies because I didn't really want to go. I was just terrified. I don't know how to camp. I'm not a camper. I don't want to backpack for 10 days. And that's what Bryant does. And so it was intimidating to me. And then one time he said to me again, hey, I'm going out to the woods. Do you want to come with me? I think it'll be great. We can stay out there, you know, maybe for like a week. And I was about to say no. And we were in the office downtown in Pioneer Square. And I looked out the window and, you know, it was this urban street, construction vehicles. Some guy ran in an alleyway and was taking a hit off of a pipe. And I thought, here is this man who has been inviting me out to a place that is so different from the world that I see every day. And why do I keep saying no? And what would happen to me if I said yes? So I said, sure. And, you know, that yes totally changed my life.
Rosette had no idea that this relationship would stretch on for years and would push him way outside of his comfort zone. That feeling of being in the wrong place, of being a fish out of water, that's what our show is about today. We are going to continue with Rosette's story now about two people who struggle in very different ways to adapt to their environment.
Well, I borrowed a friend's tent and packed up and picked up Bryant in Woodland Park, and, you know, we drove out and started hiking in.
The elk trails to me are the key to finding some of the most unique and pristine areas in this park.
Bryant walks so fast on the trail, and so that sometimes meant that he would turn a corner and I wouldn't see him. And the backpack I had on, I didn't know how to put it on, so it kept hitting me in the back of the head, so I couldn't really look forward. I could only look at my feet. So it was horrible. I was miserable. I was so miserable. I'm black, and my whole life, my family has always told me, like, black people don't go camping. You're going to get killed out there, boy. That is crazy. Don't go do that. But I realized that I had absorbed this whole fear of the wilderness that my whole family and all the black people I knew all had. In the city, I know what bus to take. I can figure out how to get somewhere. But out in the wilderness, like, I don't know how to read the land. I was clueless, totally clueless. I was in Bryant's territory. We would be walking through the woods and he would just turn off the trail and he'd go start walking. I'm like, where are you going? He's like, I'm following the elk trail. And I'm like, what elk trail? He's like, we're standing on the elk trail, look. And then I would look down and I realized that we were standing in this little trail, which I hadn't noticed. And he could be so calm. You know, we'd have these moments where we would sit by the river and he would just sit there and I would look at him and he would seem so at peace.
I love humanity, but I also love the variety and beauty of the life of this world. The song of the wren, the bugles of the elk.
And then Bryant decided that he was going to go on a little solo journey himself. And so he left me alone. And I was just terrified, so terrified that something bad was going to happen to me. And I couldn't look at anything. And so I was sitting there next to this tree, and I heard this sound, this zzzz, but it was really loud. And I look, and there is this hummingbird that is just fluttering in the air, like looking right at me. You know, it must have hung out for like 30, 45 seconds. And then the hummingbird left, and I thought, what am I doing? I am terrified of a hummingbird. So I kind of just thought, you know what? You got to let it go. You're out here in this place. It's beautiful. Try to see what's out here and stop living in your head and live in the moment. You know, who knows why things happen? Who knows why people come together, right? But I realized that in some way, Bryant was the agent that helped me become more comfortable in the wilderness, the place that terrified me, that I didn't understand. And so when we got back from our trip, we found out shortly after that there was a fire in Olympic National Park. And so this motivated Bryant even more. He was going to go to the park and document it, and he was going to be in the woods for 6 months. I thought that was a little much. But Bryant was really gung-ho about it. He said he knew what to do. He had his camera. He was going to document it. And he was going to make this record of a drought and a rainforest, which, of course, seemed ironic to him. So here it is. It's June 2015. It's July 2015. Bryant says, I'm going to go out. Still hasn't gone out. August 2015. Fire still going. Bryant says he wants to go out, but he hasn't gone. Then it's September 2015, fire is still smoldering, Bryant hasn't made it. Why hasn't Bryant made it? He's been on a drinking binge, so he hasn't been able to get out there. So finally, in mid-September 2015, I'm like, Bryant, listen, if you really want to go out there, I will go out there, let's go. We finally go out there, but we couldn't go farther up the trail because the trail was closed because of the fire. This frustrated Bryant.
Turn around, it's something else.
And also, Bryant had gone cold turkey and he was having the DTs. So he was shaking, he was sweating, he was a mess. He was a total mess.
I want to get off with the alcohol for good.
I thought, is this what I'm going to have to go through for the next 6-7 days? Is to listen to someone yell and cry and scream every 15 minutes?
You get a ticket to eternity in hell!
And the last day we were there, we were walking up the trail, and walking down the trail comes the chief fire management officer of Olympic National Park, who had opened up the trail. So Brian's like, we're going to go. So we like stormed 7 miles up trail, and we get to this place where we could see where the fire was, and it was so completely anticlimactic. I mean, it was just sort of this brown spot in the green wilderness, and there was a little wisp of smoke. So it was just this trip that for Bryant was really frustrating. For me, it was liberating. It was so beautiful. I'd never heard bugling elk before. It was a stunning, unearthly sound. We had this one encounter where this giant bull elk walked across the trail as we were walking back to our camp. And I mean, the animal was massive. I'd never seen an animal that big, that close. So it was incredible. And I was just pointing out to Brian all these beautiful moments we had had on this trip. But to him, it was just frustration. Because to him, it was the opportunity to change his life. He thought, if I can document this, people will listen to me and pay attention to me. And then I'll be taken for real and I'll be serious. And I'm going to be a different person. And my life's going to change. But that's not how it went. You know, Bryant had to go back to the streets. So there it is. It's October 2015, November, December. Bryant can't let go of this idea of 6 months. He really wants to do it. Finally, he's like, you know, I'm going to start in January of 2016. And I'm like, January? Brian, it's freezing. He said, oh, it's not that bad. I mean, I sleep outside in the city. It's not that much colder in the park out there. So this time we decided to go to the Ho Rainforest. We left the first week of January 2016. And, you know, I'd spent those several days, and then Brian was going to start his journey, his 6 months. And so I got in the van and drove away and left him there. And we had planned to meet up in 6 weeks. So we met up, and then I'm planning to go back to the city, and he goes, you know what? I think I'm going to leave, and I'm going to go back to the city with you. And I'm like, really? What about your 6 months? He said, well, I got to get a permit, and, you know, I can just come back in a week or two once I get the permit. So we came back to the city, and then I found out why we came back to the city.
So did you have something to drink when you went to Forks one time?
Yeah, I did.
Brian admitted that he had hitchhiked out and gotten some beers.
How many? Just one?
Three.
And had gotten drunk.
Well,
and he was embarrassed to tell me. And then he didn't go back. And I was like, Brian, what's going on? He said, well, you know, when I was out there that time and I'd been drinking, I actually had an altercation. I said, what do you mean, an altercation? He said, well, I had an altercation with the ranger. She was asking me some questions, and she took me in her office, and I got loud and got belligerent, and then she handcuffed me, and then she drove me to the police station in Forks, and they kept me overnight. I was like, Bryant? And now he had to go to court. So I drove him to court. And I don't know how it happened, but he had the nicest magistrate in the world.
So it's Wednesday, May 4th. Brian, you just had your little Raymond. How do you think it all went?
Actually, I feel it went far better than how I thought it would go when I first got in trouble.
He was so nice to Brian. The judge talked to him for a little bit and said, you know what, I realize that you do better off in the woods than you do in the city, so let's get you out of court and let's get you back into the woods. fine Bryant $235. That was it. It was such a blessing. I couldn't believe that he'd gotten off that easy. You know, there I was. It was the summer of 2016, and Bryant still hadn't gone back out into the woods to do his 6 months. And then I saw that his dream was slipping away. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? I can't save it for him, but maybe I can try to help him one more time. And I'm like, Bryant, listen, if you want to go, like, you know what? Come on, let's go. Like, I'll totally take you. And so we went out again in August 2016. And he was like, okay, I'm going to stay out here and I'm going to be out here and I'm going to really do it. And then 5 weeks later, I got a phone call and it was Bryant saying that he was coming back to the city. And that was pretty much the last time he went back to the woods. So that was heartbreaking. I just saw how important the woods were to him. What joy and beauty had done for his life. And it was sad to know that this man who had shown me that joy and that beauty couldn't find his way back out there to experience it again himself. And I still hope that he can reach it one day. But I know as the days go on and as he gets older, that it becomes harder and harder and harder. But also the thing that happened was that I realized that I could do something that I didn't think that I could do. And so I decided, you know what? I'm going to go on a solo journey. And so I took a solo trip and I went out by myself and went 7-8 miles up the trail and put my tent out. And then the next 2 days, I didn't see a person. And I realized I never had a time where I hadn't seen someone for 2 days.
It is, what is it, like the 14th of September? And I did it. Time just seemed like it was turned to syrup. It just took for, not forever, it was just slow. And it was so
it was
nice, it didn't rain.
Like three of the best days of my life. And I had the four tweets. So, this man who had taken these solo journeys, who kept inviting me to go, led me to go on my own solo journey. And my whole life changed. One time when we were out in the woods, he said to me, you know what? I want my story to have a happy ending. And I said, Bryant, you know what? I do too. I said, but you know, maybe your story will be bittersweet. And maybe there's a lot for everyone else in the story of someone who has a bittersweet tale.
Rosette Royale is a journalist in Seattle. You can see some of Bryant's photographs on our website. Go to knkxsoundeffect.org. You're listening to Sound Effect. Our theme today is Fish Out of Water. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Perry Como.
The bluest skies you've ever seen are in Seattle. And the hills, the greenest green in Seattle.
That's the theme song to the short-lived TV show Here Come the Brides. In the show, 1860s Seattle is faced with losing its lumberjacks to other cities because Seattle doesn't have enough women, until they import a bunch of marriageable ladies from the East Coast, and hilarity ensues. Kind of an outlandish premise, right? Except that it really happened. Asa Mercer was president of the University of Washington. At the time, they had exactly one student. And he took it on himself to find wives for the loggers in Lowell, Massachusetts. Sue Armitage is a former professor of history at Washington State University, and she told us the story of this unusual journey to Washington Territory.
Seattle was only about a little bit more than 10 years old, and it was a pretty scraggly place, and it's mostly men. By the 1860s, the count was at the time that there were 9 men for every woman in town. Let me qualify that carefully, every white woman in town. And so Asa Mercer, who at that point was all of, I think, maybe 26 years old, Mercer got this bright idea that he will import some women from the East. And the reason why he thought that was a good idea was because there was a civil war going on, and there was a shortage of men on the East Coast because so many were in the armies, both North and South, and so many were being killed. And, you know, from our perspective today, I think this is perhaps the most important thing to really emphasize. All women expected to get married because their other options were so bad. Basically, being a maid in someone else's house. There were no jobs for women. So Mercer's idea was that some of those women might be willing to come out to Seattle and essentially be among the founders of the city, help civilize this frontier town of Seattle. There were two waves of Lowell girls. There were 11 in the first trip, and as everybody expected, almost all of them got married, some of them immediately, practically on the dock, because they were besieged by men looking for women. It must have been quite a challenge to sort out, except for probably the most famous woman, a woman named Lizzie Ordway, who was the oldest of the Mercer's girls. She was 35, heavens, and she never intended to get married, and she did indeed teach school, and she was in Seattle. She was the first teacher in the first public school, and she never did marry. But there was a problem, and it's the problem that has sort of dogged this story ever since, which is that the newspapers grabbed hold of this and made it into sort of a scandal. Who are these women who are willing to go out and marry anybody they see? Are they selling themselves? Is Mercer himself really like, for want of, to put it really bluntly, is he a pimp and other ridiculous things? I mean, it was a real titillating, sexy scandal in a lot of the more disreputable papers. And it seems to me, from what I've read, that there were an awful lot of disreputable papers. Mercer had great ambitions for the second expedition. He really did announce that he was going to bring 700 women back to Seattle, which was preposterous. And it's clear that Mercer's getting carried away by his own sense that he's really succeeded so well in the first edition, in the first expedition. So, of course, he goes back to the East Coast, and the circumstances are not the same. He actually lands in New York on the day that Lincoln is assassinated, when the whole country is in mourning, or half of the country, the northern half. And the economic circumstances have changed, too. The slump that had hit Lowell at the earlier time is ending, and there are more jobs for women and more opportunities, and it took Mercer a while to find enough, what he hoped would be enough women to bring west with him in the second expedition. But the long and short of it was that Mercer was not successful in finding 700 women. He only found 35. And they signed on for a trip that went from New York down around Cape Horn in South America and all the way up the Pacific coast. And on that second expedition, there was a newspaper reporter, Roger Conant, his name was. And most of what we know about the trip itself and the second expedition comes from Conant's journal and the newspaper articles that he wrote. The journal entries painted a very much more complicated picture of the group of women themselves. There was a group of perfectly respectable young women who accepted Mercer's idea that he was sort of their chaperone. But there was quite a considerable number of others who were interested, very interested, in the sailors and the officers on the ship that they traveled on. And this second bunch, they teased Mercer absolutely unmercifully. They called him the old man. At this point, he was, what, maybe 30? Poor Mercer. Conan didn't like him. And so he's very happy to report all this gossip about what Mercer may or may not have done. But the juiciest was that Mercer developed a crush on one of the young women.
Mercer became enamored of a young maiden of good rapport and fair to look upon, and without giving her the slightest intimation of what he was about to do, not even so much as a tender look or an evening's courtship, Asa invited her to his stateroom, told her he loved her enough to marry her, and opened his arms and smiled fondly upon her. The maiden laughed right in his face.
And walked out, which I really like. It's a nice piece of confirmation that these women were not sort of passive sheep that Mercer could do anything with. So it's a mixed bunch. But the point is that these women, so far as we can tell, most of them turned out to be solid Seattle citizens and did really indeed contribute to the civilizing of Seattle, which at that point needed a fair amount of civilizing. I suppose one of the downsides of this is to underline yet again how few real opportunities there were for women to be independent. Economically, it was difficult. Socially, it was difficult, as we know from all the sort of scandalous stuff that surrounded these women who took their lives into their own hands. I think it must have been a tremendous adventure.
I'll take you home again, Kathleen.
That's Sue Armitage, a former history professor who wrote the foreword to the latest edition of Roger Conant's book, Mercer's Bells, The Journey of a Reporter. That story was produced by Kevin Kenistad.
Has ever been since first you were my bonnie bride. The roses all have left your cheeks. I've watched them fade away.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Thanksgiving Dinner. This is the house where Christina Hayes grew up in the Tri-Cities in eastern Washington. Her parents, who met in Bible college, are there, along with extended family. There's turkey and stuffing and apple pie. By all appearances, this is a completely typical American family holiday. But Christina, who lives in Seattle, brought along a tape recorder this year, and she interviewed her mom and dad about some of the things that make this family anything but typical.
My sister and I came home one day. I think we were just out playing in the neighborhood, and we came home. It was our dad's birthday, so we wanted to be there for dinner for him. And when we walked in the door, my mom and dad were at the dining room table crying and sent us to our rooms. We never got an explanation for that.
I always had this deep, dark secret that I could never talk to anybody about, you know, because everything had to be so hidden and everything was so dirty and bad and against God and, you know, that whole thing. But it was very present in my life and I couldn't get around it. Maybe early teens, I would say, I became more astutely aware that I really did think the male body was pretty interesting. One of my favorite things was walking past the boys' locker room, and every once in a while the door would be open and I'd see these guys prancing around in their jock straps, and it was like, oh my God, I couldn't keep my eyes off of them, and I thought, why is that?
My name is May Sharif. I live in Richland, Washington. Well, I went to a Bible college in Pennsylvania, And there was a very handsome Italian. I've always had a thing for Italians. And he was just a doll, and he was tender-hearted.
Would it be accurate to say you guys were more like your best friend, like a girlfriend?
Yeah, because he liked everything I liked. He cleaned better than I did. His ironing was beautiful. And it was, he had a gentle spirit. I had gone home and met the family, and we went on a church visitation, something or other. Pastor stepped on the church, and he leaned over to me and kind of let me know that David was confused sexually, and that it was all right, that he just needed to be married, and that that's all he needed was a good Christian woman.
It's like straddling that middle line down the road, one leg on one side, one leg on the other side, and I did that most of my life.
He was dealing with it for years, and I really didn't put my finger on it, that this gentle person was living a dual life.
You know, I get such a kick out of people that say, oh, homosexuality is something you choose. I mean, you know, I can tell you very, very clearly that I tried everything in my power not to be gay. I went through 20-some years of therapy. I went through like 3 different exorcisms. It was so confusing. I can't even tell you how confusing it was. I mean, because even after the laying on of hands, the anointing with oil, the speaking in tongues, the whole thing, which is all part of my religious tradition, none of it did anything. I woke up in the middle of the night, and I walked out into the kitchen completely naked, and I threw myself on the floor and buried my face in the floor. And I prayed for hours, and I cried out to God and asked God to remove this thing from me. I said, I can't do this anymore.
I noticed that my mom and dad said they started going to a church. And that week they let us know these people would be coming to our house for the service. And I'm like, cool. And when they left, I said to my sister, he said, something seems really odd about some of those people. Like there was a man there in particular, and I kept staring at him because something wasn't right. Kind of dirty, grungy teeth and flannel shirt, just reeked of cigarettes. And I remember asking her later, I'm like, did you know what was going on with that dude? And she laughed. She goes, that's a woman. And then we started noticing they started hanging out with several couples, and they were gay couples. We were at one of the couples' house for dinner, Renee and Teresa. And Renee's daughter and I were close in age. We're back in the bedroom, and she said, I've heard a rumor, and I don't know how to tell you this, but the rumor is that the reason your dad and mom are kind of doing this thing is because your dad's gay.
I had a wife that I'd been with for over 20 years, and I thought, if I open this door, what's going to happen? But another part of me said, you don't have any choice. You have to open this door. So I sat down with her and I said, I got to tell you something and you're not going to like it. And she said, what? And I said, I'm gay. And that was the first time in my life I was ever able to verbalize, you know, that and identify that's who I really was.
Of course, first I was in shock. And then it made total sense to me. Of course you're gay. It just made sense.
Dad just wasn't around anymore. He started to kind of disconnect and peace out, check out, see you later. My mom all but had a nervous breakdown. I found her once. I went into her room because I heard the sound. I thought our cat was like stuck under the bed. It sounded like that moaning of a cat. And I found my mom in the corner of the room between the bed and the wall in a fetal position, rocking. It was horrific. Just a few months later, my sister came home from college, and she brought her best friend with her. And they were kissing and hugging and so on, and I accidentally stumbled upon it. I had no idea this was her actual girlfriend. So she didn't come out to me, and she kind of was forced to come out to me. Mom couldn't about handle life.
I cried for days because I didn't want her to go through what David had gone through. And I wanted grandkids. I was completely selfish.
And Teresa,
a lesbian friend that had been hanging out at our house,
and Renee had just broken up. So she and Teresa were helping each other through their processes. And then Mom started staying the night at Teresa's.
We were doing a load of laundry and our hands touched. And when she touched me, I had electricity going right through my body. And I thought, uh-oh, you haven't felt that in a long time.
Well, she informed me that she thought she had feelings for our friend. And I just, yeah, it was just mind-boggling.
So my mom went from, I can't stand gay people, they're all this, they're all that, to, oh, by the way, I'm with Teresa. And, oh, by the way, we're getting an apartment and you have to live with us. You hear people talk about, I was struggling with being gay and I didn't know how to come out. I was struggling with being straight because I'm like, what is wrong with me?
David was angry at first because I found somebody before he did. And I think in a way I was kind of glad that I first found that. I didn't want to see him that happy that quick.
And I said, the only thing that I can ask of you right now is the day that you decide to move out, when I come home from work that night, just be gone, because I'll never, said emotionally, I'll never be able to watch you leave. So when I came home from work that night, for the first time in 22 years, I came home to an empty house.
I'm trying to think when things seemed to get better. It was probably a couple years. They were both there when I gave birth to my child, like in the room. Another thing that helped, believe it or not, my dad moved to Oregon. He moved to Portland. And I think that separation really, really helped them heal.
Well, I knew for myself that there was no way I didn't love you. There was no way that I didn't love your sister. There was no way that I didn't love your mother. I don't know how that works in other families, but I know in our family that's how it worked.
We are the best of friends. I love David dearly. I always will. If we didn't go through those things, we would have never been able to be the family unit we are. We have Christmas together, Thanksgiving together, and we laugh together, we joke together, and we respect each other. And it's been through the hardest times, but it's been very well worth every second.
We are what you would expect to see on Thanksgiving. I have my son and his girlfriend, my grandchild, daughter, her fiance. My dad and his partner were there. My mom and her wife were there. My sister, we're playing, we're laughing, we're joking, we're prepping food. We are like the Hallmark family.
Christina Hayes lives in Seattle. You're listening to Sound Effect from 88.5. Gabriel Spitzer here, and today we're telling stories of fish out of water. Immigrants and refugees can find themselves plopped down into completely foreign terrain. The language sounds like gibberish, people look different, the customs are unfamiliar. And that's how it was years ago for Saporn Sim when she fled Cambodia in 1979. Now she's working to ease that transition for other refugees, and through the environmental nonprofit ECOS, helps show them how to live healthier lives in the Seattle area. 88.5's Bellamy Palethorpe went to meet her at a fishing pier on the Lower Duwamish Waterway.
This is not the kind of place where you would expect to find a fishing pier. their large trucks constantly rumbling by on their way to port. Some trains, too. Containers are piled high in several directions, and there's a cement plant nearby. This is the heart of industrial Seattle. But tucked away beneath the Spokane Street Viaduct and the West Seattle Bridge is one of the most popular areas for locals to catch fish.
During the salmon season, you can see packed of fishers standing shoulder to shoulder and try to fish from here.
It's kind of amazing to think in this industrial place right on the highway that you'd have fishermen shoulder to shoulder.
Yes, shoulder to shoulder during the fishing season.
Saporn Sim has spent a lot of time here observing and talking to fishermen for a public health study with the EPA and local authorities. Because this is actually one of the worst places to fish for anything but salmon. Soil at the bottom of the river is full of chemicals such as PCBs, dioxin, and arsenic. And any fish that live in this part of the river are not safe to eat. Signs here warn of that health risk. But Saporn says their study found that still at least a quarter of the anglers here take home tainted crab, flounder, perch, and other bottom fish.
The thing is, majority of people who fish are, you know, people of color, the non-English speaking people, and the sign does not help them because they don't read and write the language.
That experience of being in a foreign land and not understanding how everyday things in a shiny new place could actually harm you is something Saporn Sim knows all too well. And though she's a small and very modest person, she has quite a story to tell. She fled the war in Cambodia when she was 13 and spent all of her teen years in a refugee camp. But before we get to that, let's hear how she grew up in a small village in Battambang province.
My parents were farmers. We were poor, but life was very peaceful before the war. We make a living by growing rice crop. I was carried in the cart that was carried by the cow to the farm with my dad, with my mom. My dad plowed using the cow to pull, and I was behind him collecting snail, water snail, and catching fish right along the plow.
They told time by the sun and would break for lunch at noon when it was straight up in the sky. Her mom harvested vegetables fresh from the farm and cooked them with the snails and crabs and fish that the kids caught every day.
Everything all natural, resources clean, because no industrial, nothing. It's very organic. It was beautiful, the life back then. I really miss that so much.
This peaceful rural life was soon shattered by war. The Vietnamese army was occupying the country after overthrowing the communists in the Khmer Rouge regime. Their mother fled first. A few months later, in 1979, Saporn and her brother followed.
We walked days and nights and weeks and months to just walk across the border. Some people blasted by landmines.
Others were robbed. She remembers seeing bodies strewn around. She suffered from severe asthma and thought she wouldn't make it. They traveled more than 700 miles.
It was hard, but I was lucky to be alive.
That luck held up, and they made it, with tens of thousands of others, to Khao Dang, a refugee camp in eastern Thailand. She lived there for 6 years, learning to read and write behind barbed wire. She got beat up once for sneaking out of the camp to forage for firewood, but eventually it became a kind of home.
That was like a better place for me already, that's what I thought. So even though we didn't have everything, there's no much resources, but still better than during the communist regime.
When Saporn was 19, they got refugee status with a sponsor in Spokane, Washington. They arrived in the winter of 1985.
That was a really culture shock for me because I never seen snow in my life before I arrived to the United States. As soon as I got off the airplane, my teeth were chattering.
Did you know what snow was?
We have heard something about that, but it's just never seen in real. It was so cold too, because I came from a country where it's warm all the time, and it was so much different.
After about 6 or 7 months, they moved to Seattle and settled in an apartment in South Park. And because it was still so cold to them, they never opened any windows. Black mold covered the walls, and they used lots of pure bleach to try and kill it.
So I used bleach to clean my apartment, and I didn't know that bleach, you know, the harsh chemical from the bleach could harm my already injured lung that I've had for years from my childhood.
She became very sick to the point of coughing up blood. Also because the family used laundry detergent for bathing, thinking it was all just soap because they didn't understand the labels. Saporn says this is what motivates her to do the work she does now, educating new immigrants and refugees about simple ways they can save money and protect their health, like using vinegar and baking soda for cleaning, or beer traps to kill slugs.
You know, the beer that you drink. So people just like, are you sure? You know, beer can get rid of slug? I say, yes, because I've done it myself.
To tie all of this information together for newcomers and to show why it's important to stay away from chemicals, Saporn now takes new arrivals on field trips to see the source of Seattle's drinking water, the Cedar River watershed. It's on pristine land in a protected area 45 miles east of the city near North Bend.
It's beautiful scenery. It's really sparkle my eyes.
Saporn says the aim of these field trips is to give newcomers a feeling of ownership, so they'll want to help take care of the resource. She remembers one woman in particular, part of a group of Burmese and Bhutanese immigrants.
Her impression was saying, wow, before I miss my hometown so much, in here I feel so miserable and miss my hometown. After I see this watershed, I feel like home. I feel like home. That's the impression that she say. And also other people said, wow, from now on, I don't have to buy bottled water anymore because I can just drink water from my tap because they've seen the source and how it's being processed and how being protected.
But amidst successes like these, there is one constant challenge that Saporn is up against in her work. It's trust. She says many refugees have complete trust in the U.S. government. They think the system is looking out for all of their interests, and this means they assume that anything for sale in a supermarket is safe.
And they would say that if it's harmful to people, the government wouldn't allow that to be available in a store. The same thing about eating fish, the residential fish from the Wabash River.
So Saporn Sim has her work cut out for her. She'll be keeping her eye on this spot on the lower Duwamish for as long as it takes to educate these newcomers who are like fish out of water themselves. People who are full of hope and trust, who are getting used to a new place. People who rely on this unassuming woman for information because they cannot yet read the warning signs to not eat what lives in the water here on this polluted stretch of Seattle's only river.
Bellamy Palethorpe covers the environment for KNKX. That's it for today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had contributions this week from Rosette Royale, Christina Hayes, and Bellamy Palethorpe. Special thanks to Ed Ronco. Our intern is Janae Janik, and Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. You can find our podcast on Apple Podcasts or lots of other places. We're on Facebook under KNKX Sound Effect, and you can send us your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. We'll be back next week when we head into the woods. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.